All right, folks, we're going to take a little break there. Dot, 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 dash. Spells the letter V in Morse code. And as the Second World War went on, the Allies co-opted this. Beethoven's Fifth, they said, is V for victory. But the recording we just heard was made during the very first days of the Second World War, just as the Nazis were tumbling into Poland, the Blitzkrieg. The German army, the Wehrmacht, and the Panzer divisions were pouring into Poland. And there is Wilhelm Furtwängler standing on the podium back there in Berlin conducting Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Welcome back to Post Classical. We got Joe Horowitz, Angel Gil Ordóñez, and me, Bill McLaughlin. Joe, what do you hear in this performance we were just listening to?
My thought in including this today, even though I'm tired of hearing Beethoven's Fifth, is that it resonates with the moment in a way that Bruckner and Brahms do not, because it's a militant piece. It's a bellicose piece. Mm-hmm. And we could ask ourselves in what ways it's channeled by Furtwängler in the actual midst of wartime.
You know, for me, I had just exactly the opposite response to it. After listening to Brahms 1 finale and opening the Bruckner 9th, this piece sounded so classical to me, so lighthearted by it in a way. Yeah. I mean, it's a classical symphony, and the others are big romantic pieces. So I hear what you're saying, the energy that they're applying to this performance. Mm-hmm. But the music itself, it doesn't sound as big as Brahms, and it doesn't sound as profound as Bruckner. And how did you feel about this performance?
I think I agree with you. I mean, there is not the weight and the depth of what we heard before. It's more, it's going back to the origins of German classical.
Yeah, this is about 1806.
Yeah.
It's a long way back in a way.
So,
how about if we go to the end of this piece? There's a brilliant thing that Beethoven does, sort of blending in the third and fourth moments. The third moment is a scherzo, which, like most scherzos and minuets, has a trio. And that comes back, and then we get this long extended connection to the finale. He's kind of aching and aching and aching to get from C minor to, guess what, C major, and the day is won for the good guys. Let's hear this now. Here are the third and fourth movements of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Once again, a performance of the Berlin Philharmonic under Wilhelm Furtwängler, September 1939. Keep that in your mind as you're listening to this performance. We'll see what we can hear. And try to put yourself in that audience in Berlin. What would you have been thinking? It's just the opening of the Second World War.
Thank you.
Wow, that triumphant C major at the beginning of the last movement, that does sound like wartime stuff to
me. Absolutely.
You think it's the same thing?
I agree with you there, in that last movement, no doubt.
We were just listening to the Berlin Philharmonic playing a recording of a concert made in September 1939. And yep, you history buffs are right. That was exactly when the German army and the Panzer divisions rolled into Poland. Blitzkrieg, the beginning of the war, concert with Wilhelm Furtwängler staying on the podium back there in Berlin. That's really interesting. That puts into context now, because we heard earlier in this program the very last performance before the end of the war. It was January of 1945. Now, here we were, September 1939. What a terrible story those years are between. What should we listen to next, Joe?
This is actually your request, Bill. Mm. One of Furtwängler's most famous interpretations is of the great Schubert 9 C major symphony, which I would say doesn't sound at all Viennese as he performs it. There's a wonderful recording by Joseph Cripps. Maybe you've heard it with the London Symphony.
I don't know.
That if we're talking about antipodes before, Celibidache and Furtwängler and Bruckner, it's amazing how different this music comes across performed by Cripps in a gemütlich style compared to this demonic Germanic interpretation by Furtwängler. There are various versions of the Schubert 9 left by Furtwängler. I'm not familiar with them all, but this is the one that was recorded in wartime, and the date is December 42, which means they're already using magnetic tape, and the last performance we just heard was not magnetic tape.
Can you hear a little hiss?
Could tell the difference.
And I'll be gone now in this next performance.
These are the first symphonic recordings that were recorded with tape, and Furtwängler was very happy with them and with the dynamic range that was captured.
What we're going to hear is the second movement, which is a peculiar movement. I was talking with my old friend Gary Golson years ago. There are three Schubert sonatas all in A minor. He was talking to me. He said, Bill, I think Schubert is really Meshuggah in A minor. There's something a little bit off about him. And all three of those sonatas have that quality, as does this piece. It's kind of a little march, but it's in the wrong key. You should have a march in a major key, not a minor key. And it shouldn't be this spooky little quirky tune. But what really catches my mind is that he builds up a firestorm in the middle of this. That's my memory of this piece. I remember having this recording for years.
Yeah, the firestorm is Furtwängler's. You won't hear it in the Cripps recording. And you're right, there's something anomalous about this movement. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to capture in words what the hell it is. Mm-hmm. It's a march, but not really. It's a slow movement, but not really. Mm-hmm. It is and is not gemütlich. The four repeated notes, which we hear at the end of this oboe solo that begins the movement, turn into an unexpected motif. And you'll recall that that comes back at the end of the finale, those four repeated notes. So I've never heard this before, this particular Furtwängler recording.
You know, I think Schubert is the greatest composer of repeated notes that ever existed. There's a spot in here just the end where the horn keeps playing a single note and the strings, single note, single note. So you couldn't make that work, but he does. It's breathtaking.
Well, that's a wonderful observation, and it's certainly pertinent to this particular movement of the Ninth Symphony by Schubert.
So let's listen. Give me the date again, Joe.
December 1942.
Dark days.
Yes, let's remember dark days.
Thank you. Wow, what music.
Fantastic.
Always takes my breath away when I hear that piece. We were just listening. This is post-classical, if you've just tuned in a very pre-post-classical mood today, because Joe Horowitz brought on all these wonderful recordings of the Berlin Philharmonic made during the war years. We were just listening to a recording made in 1942 that was the slow movement, if you can call it a slow movement, of Schubert's Great C Major Symphony. It's a prophetic kind of piece because we're wondering, wow, can you have a march in a minor key? It doesn't make sense. And then the clarinet comes in its major key for a little while, and we can almost imagine the young men, brave young men dressed in their brand new uniforms marching down the streets of Vienna. They're going off to war, and they won't look so good in a little while. And then comes that tremendous climax in the center of it. That breaks my mind. It gets more and more powerful, powerful. And the last couple of notes, those eighth notes, are like, ah, ah, it's like a scream. And then it's interesting because Schubert writes three beats of rest. That's all. Mm-hmm. And this tempo, it's like one, two, three, and I should go ahead. But when Furtwängler conducts it, it lasts forever.
Forever.
That space.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, this time we broke it. We really broke civilization. You get pizzicato in the strings, and the cello reaches out to put his arm around our shoulders. Consolation.
Yeah, something truly awful happens at that moment. Uh-huh. I never thought of it in the context of the war, but I don't know what his interpretation of this piece might have sounded like before the war. Mm. I know the famous studio recording he made after the war, where there's this same enormous climax. I would wager that the silence is longer in this performance.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Which is to say that this catastrophe is bigger. And I think it's absolutely pertinent to talk, as you just did, about a catastrophe of civilization. Mm-hmm. Something never imagined by Schubert when he wrote this music.
Yeah.
But this is one of the most mysterious feats in the performances of Furtwängler.
Yeah.
I had the experience of sharing with my wife, Agnes, whom you both know, his post-war recording of the Pathetic Symphony, Radio Cairo, I think it's 1951.
No kidding.
And she said, this is Tchaikovsky, of course, she said, it sounds like a symphony about World War II. And it does.
Wow.
Just as this sounds like a symphony about World War II.
Yeah. Brendel, Alfred Brendel said about Schubert, he seems to be a sleepwalker. And what I really think he's getting on, there's a kind of dream world in Schubert, and he lulls you in.
Yeah.
But never to this degree. I mean,
I know.
Furtwängler, what matters to him in this movement, it seems to me, are two things. The famous passage with the horn, which Schumann famously, and I won't get this right, but he talked about how the orchestra is listening to a distant horn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the passage you just referred to. And what he wants to do is set this movement up so he can take those two passages as slowly as possible for opposite reasons.
Yeah.
In the first, you just described it, he's lulling you into a cloudland.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second, I think you're right. It's like the end of civilization.
Right.
Some world apocalyptic catastrophe.
Right, and we march right over the abyss, and we're still marching. We're still marching, and you fall, and you think, oh, my God, what have we done?
Yeah. But on the other hand, also this sad irony of Mahler at the beginning.
Is a Mahler movement, Otto.
It is.
And I will tell you that the most evocative and detailed description I know of any Mahler performance is Arthur Farwell's review of Mahler conducting Schubert's Ninth Symphony with the New York Philharmonic.
I can imagine that.
Which is paragraphs long.
Yeah,
really.
And you read it and you can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And what you hear is a Mahler symphony. Not this performance. It's a performance, he said, Farwell did, that it was pursued by the imp of the perverse. Those are his words. But it was alive at every moment, even though it challenged his understanding of the piece, which is to say, sharp accents.
Absolutely.
Even in the oboe solo.
Even the oboe, in the clarinet.
No, but I'm talking about Mahler's performance of Schubert's Ninth. He absolutely turned it into a Mahler symphony. And this movement, which we just heard, is so evocative, so prescient of Mahler. But, Bill, I thank you for the two observations you made, and they're antithetical. On the one hand, he's lulling us into a cloudland, and then he's pummeling us with this world catastrophe.
With Schubert, I always feel it was like like Marshall McLuhan. Like some people can see over the horizon, distant early warning system. Remember that when he used to talk about that during the Cold War? Schubert could see over the horizon. He can see what's coming that's not in our vision, but he already knows it.
He already knows it, yeah.
I don't know what he was thinking. We think this was composed in 1828. We're not sure. If it was, that's the last year of his life when he knew he was dying and he was very ill. And a lot of that, Zig, not all of it, is about illness and the sensibility, you know, like Liermann at the end of Winterreise becomes absurd in almost Dostoevskyan in these some of these late Schubert pieces with their vision of God knows what, some very, very dark place of the soul. And that dark place of the soul in this Furtwängler performance of this movement becomes something else, a dark place for humankind.
Thanks for including it. When we spoke about this a month ago, do you have this recording? Because I had an old DG recording, and it turns out this is the one I was thinking of. Yeah. Interesting, with all this darkness, Schubert writes two lively, joyous pieces coming up. The third and fourth movement, the scherzo and the finale. It's a romp. It's a C major romp.
Well, maybe that's how we should end the show.
All right.
With the third and fourth movements of the Schubert Nine.
Good idea.
Probably a better idea. We were thinking about Tchaikovsky Pathetique, but we want you people all to survive the week. Yeah, let's hear this.
Let's hear the rest of this performance.
Thanks.
I've never heard it before.
Okay. So it's a scherzo and a finale which goes like blue blazes. Once again, our conductor is Wilhelm Furtwängler. He's conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. And this is a performance recorded in December of 1942, Dark Days. Thank you. I swear, that does my heart a lot of good.
Fantastic, fantastic. The use of the brass is phenomenal in the symphony. It's really fascinating.
I'm so glad we changed our mind. Well, now with this joyous music. Yep. Beautiful stuff, Joe.
Is that what it is? Is it joyous?
It is. Can you kick up your heels?
I don't know.
Not if you're a string player. You're going to take your arm and put it in Epsom salts to dump it to get over. That wears you out. No, of course, yes.
It makes a positive statement that's exhilarating and exalting. But I think Schubert may have imagined it as a joyous movement. But well, I don't find this a joyous experience. It's an emphatic and a positive experience. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it joyous.
Made me happy.
It makes you happy.
Yeah, it does.
What I would like to mention is the modification of tempo in this movement. Mm-hmm. Parts of it are extremely fast and thrilling, but if the whole thing were that fast, it would be unbearable. So the trick is to slow it down without really making it very noticeable that you're slowing it down.
Sure.
So that you can use this play of pulse, this play of tempo. This is a very Wagnerian feature of this interpretation, certainly not composed in the score.
No.
So that you can use this play of tempo to both shape the trajectory of the piece and shape our experience of the piece.
That was incredible in the second movement. Mm-hmm. That for sure was. Mm-hmm.
But this movement is full of tempo changes.
True.
And he does. It's not something that you would normally
encounter. But they're minute. He sort of disguises them. Some of the times when he changes tempo, he's making a big point of it. Here he said, it just comes off a little.
That's my point. That if they were more perceptible, it would wreck the movement.
Right. Yeah.
But if the whole movement were fast, it would also wreck the movement.
Yeah, because
so you have to figure out a way to disguise these tempo changes.
Well, I take my hat off to Maestro Furtwängler.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah. Really.
Do we have any further thoughts about this? We may not. Well, a wartime performance?
Well, I'm curious about the fact that you said that he enjoyed. I don't imagine Furtwängler enjoying a recording session.
No.
You said that he was happy with
the... He was very happy with the sound. First of all, he loved with the magnetic tape.
Okay.
I'm just reading the notes here. He was enthralled at the dynamic range that it captured.
Okay.
And he was very happy that there was only one microphone used because he'd had a different experience with EMI.
I see.
And he felt only with a single microphone with his balances be captured. And by the way, he likes a lot of timpani.
He does indeed.
Yes.
Well, Joe, I can't believe I'm going to let you take that beautiful box of recordings home with you today, but maybe I could drop by your house sometime and hear some more. They are wonderful. Anything more you want to share with us before you walk out of here with that treasure trove?
Yeah, I'm looking here at Richard Taruskin's note, which is very long and very engaging. Page 142, I mark his, meaning Furtwängler, definition of Deutschtum, Germanness, was elastic enough to encompass his Jewish countrymen. In an address commemorating Mendelssohn's centenary in 1947, which was coincidentally the year of his denazification, a process he doubtless relished. I'm being facetious. I mean, imagine putting them through this ordeal. Furtwängler ended with the explicit declaration that Mendelssohn, Joachim, Schenker, Mahler, they are both Jews and Germans, and then added heartbreakingly, quote, they testify that we Germans have every reason to see ourselves as a great and noble people. How tragic that this has to be emphasized today.
In 1947.
Wow.
Well.
All right. This has been illuminating. Joe Horowitz, Angel Gilordonis.
Always a treat.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Bill.
This was a real treat. This is a real step away from our usual post-classical subjects, but I loved hearing these together with you. I'm sure you folks did as well. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening tonight to Post Classical with your hosts Bill McLaughlin, Joseph Horowitz, and Angel Gil Ordonez. Our recording engineer in New York, Bill Zygmunt of Digital Island Studios. Check them out at digital-island-studios.com. The next Post Classical episode comes your way Friday, March 27th. Post Classical is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.